be seated. The next case on the en banc argument calendar is Harrison v. Harrison, case number 66157. Council ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, go ahead, Mr. Harrison.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay.
May it please the Court, my name is Kirk Harrison, and I'm both an appellant and counsel of record. It is undisputed that the greatest risk to children during a divorce and post-divorce is the continued uncertainty, instability, and conflict. Therefore, the goal at the conclusion of a divorce proceeding should be to stop the adversarial proceeding that causes that to occur. It is in this context that I ask the Court to examine the issues before it today. My motion for temporary custody was filed in this case in September of 2011. The record is clear that Vivian began a campaign to alienate me from the children starting on that date and soon thereafter. Part of that campaign was to separate me from the children as much as possible. I was advised that the continuation of the divorce proceeding was putting our children at substantial emotional risk. More specifically, that uncertainty and instability in our children's lives had to end. Therefore, the importance of a certain 50-50 joint custody agreement was paramount. I wanted the children to know with certainty when they were with me, they were with me. When they were with Vivian, they were with her. I wanted them to have a happy time with her, a happy time with me, uninterrupted. I wanted to give them the best chance possible for a happily ever after. I expressed concern to my counsel about the proposed teenage discretion provision. He assured me that they could only make a request. I respectfully disagree with the trial court's conclusion that the provision is meaningless if only provides that a request can be made because a child can always make a request. Without the provision, a child could make the request 1,000 times and the parent could deny it 1,000 times and it would not be an issue. But when the parties formulate a specific provision and that contemplates a request being made, I think it creates a duty of reasonableness on the part of the responding parent to act accordingly. And therefore, if the child requested 10 requests and denied every one, I think that would create an issue. I was adamantly opposed to the provision because it created uncertainty and instability in my children's lives, and most specifically in the mind of the 14-year-old. Instead of having this happy, uninterrupted time, now has to deal with the decision of, you know, mom wants me to go over there today. It's dad's time. We have some plans. Do I ask dad? You know, he's not going to be happy. Do I leave my 10-year-old sibling? It created all kinds of instability. The provision would also provide an incentive to Vivian to continue her efforts to alienate me. Whereas with a certain provision, what was in stone, that the custody was going to remain in place until the children were 18 years old, that motivation would be lacking and hopefully the alienation attempt would stop. The other side refused to strike the provision. I asked if we could extend the age from 14 to 16 so that our children could have 2 more years of certainty and stability in their lives. That was denied. In response to a letter that Tom Standish sent to Mr. Smith regarding my concern about foisting this responsibility on a 14-year-old, Mr. Smith responded, and it's unequivocal. He said, we're not asking Brooke to choose anything. And by the way, teenage discretion means just a request. It's unequivocal. It's in his letter. It predated the date of when we entered into this agreement. So I read the provision. I thought it meant request only. My counsel advised it meant request only. And we had the draft of the provision unequivocally telling me it meant request only. And by the way, no parent is going to have a perspective going into this thing that the courts and the lawyers actually have a provision that empowers a 14-year-old child to order a parent around. That was not within anyone's reasonable contemplation. And as the court has seen, when everything blew up after my daughter turned 14, we have the affidavit from Mr. Silverman where he says, well, I must have known. The fellow that drafted the provision didn't know. My counsel didn't know. I didn't know. I respectfully submit to this court that this court should be gravely concerned over what was said during the May 21, 2014 hearing. The trial court noted at that hearing that most teenage discretion provisions are one sentence. The child shall have teenage discretion to exercise visitation with the other parent. That's it. The trial court acknowledged that these one-line teenage discretion provisions are inherently ambiguous. But the trial court ruled that these provisions empower children. So, not unlike me, you have lay people coming in here. They never have heard of teenage discretion. And they're having these one-line provisions. And they're getting sucker punched just like I was. And they're losing their children. Why is it that only Mr. Silverman foresaw that I would lose custody of my children? An alarm must go off as to why divorce attorneys are having clients sign these ambiguous teenage discretion provisions, why the ambiguous term teenage discretion is not defined. The reason is obvious. No properly informed parent would ever agree to it.
So, Mr. Harrison, what relief are you asking for? That we reform the document, that we strike that language from hereafter? What is it that you're asking this court to do?
I'm asking for what I think needs to be done for the children and the parents of this state, not just me. I'm asking that this court is an opportunity for this court to make right what is terribly wrong. Please find that any provision which places the responsibility upon a child to determine what is in their best interest is void as against public policy. Any provision which empowers a child to determine their own custody or determine weekly modifications to their own custody is void as against public policy.
So a pronouncement that teenage discretion is and hereafter shall be void against public policy.
And any existing provisions, absolutely.
Mr. Harrison, just I guess out of curiosity, because I'm looking at the order that stated 7-11-2012,
right.
And it's signed off by the attorneys, and it's also signed off by both of you on this document that I'm looking at, stipulation and order resolving parent and child issues, and it outlines what that discretion is, and the modifying paragraph talks about its discretion. It's deemed as a may, not a must, and it doesn't alter the time that the parties have set forth.
Justice Douglas, if you'll note, there's all kinds of language in that provision that go the other way. The child shall not be empowered. Again, I would urge you to look at the language in the letter beforehand from the attorney that drafted it.
I'm not concerned about the letter. I'm concerned about the documents that were signed at the conclusion by the parties of what it says.
Teenage discretion is not defined in that provision. And I've got the attorney on the other side before we signed it telling me that discretion meant request. And I've got my own attorney telling me this grunt means request.
At paragraph 6 in this order, notwithstanding the foregoing timeshare agreement, the parents agree that each child reaching the age of 14 years, such child shall have teenage discretion with respect to the time the child desires to spend with each parent. Thus, while the parent acknowledges the foregoing timeshare arrangement, the parent further acknowledges the agreement that it is in the best interest of each of their minor children to allow each child the right to exercise such teenage discretion. And then 6.1, the parties do not intend by this section to give the children the absolute ability to determine their custodial schedule with the other parent. Rather, the parties intend to allow the children to feel comfortable in requesting and are making adjustments to their weekly schedule from time to time to spend additional time with each parent or at each parent's home. And it goes on, such adjustments shall not be prompted or suggested.
Your Honor, there is not one case in this entire country, let alone Nevada, that supports a provision like this. There's not one statute in this state or this country.
In family law, we have gone to extremes to allow the parties to enter into agreements that are actually outside of our parental structure, and we allow this under contract, feeling that the parties have freely agreed to the terms and conditions. Why is this not that situation?
Because it's clearly contrary to the best interests of the children, and that trumps everything.
And when did you determine that, Mr. Harrison? At the time that the document was signed or subsequent to the ripe old age of 14? I mean, you knew the language hasn't changed in this document. You didn't go back before the court to ask that it be set aside. You didn't make any of these arguments to the judge at the time?
I had no reason to believe anything other than that he could make a request based upon the letter from opposing counsel, the advice of my clients, and my own review of the document, until it became an incident after she turned 14. I think really importantly, again, no case, no statute that authorizes this. The other side in the brief said this judge's guide is support for the children should have a voice, implying that they were, should be empowered. The judge's guide says exactly the opposite, and this is critical. It is not the responsibility to make a decision about what is in their best interest, and that this is a vulnerable time for children between 14 and 18, and that they are still very vulnerable, and they need significant protection.
Mr. Harrison, do you want to comment on the parenting coordinator provision?
Yes. The parenting coordinator, I urge the court to read the trial court's order beginning at 1182 of the record. It provides that the parenting coordinator shall recommend issues concerning child custody. And I use the term recommend, but it's really decide because the review by the trial judge is so highly deferential. Vivian places primary reliance on this Jordan case from the District of Columbia. In that case, the court was emphatic that the parenting coordinator did not have any authority to implicate the court's exclusive responsibility to adjudicate the party's rights. I think it's important to realize...
But isn't this simply like a hearing master suggestion? As a part of, the parenting coordinator isn't adjudicating anything. The judge has to sign off on whatever the parenting coordinator suggests. They may reject it, they may accept it.
Because the deferential review, in reality, the parenting coordinator is making the decision. The problem with the parenting coordinator is it creates an environment of adversarial positioning post-divorce that encourages the continuation of conflict.
Mr. Harrison, you can't deny that there is law throughout the country that supports the appointment of a parenting coordinator under some term or definition because it allows for, hopefully, a neutral arbiter to make a decision in a case where otherwise the adult's safe.
The vast majority of the cases hold that they can't touch upon child custody. The vast majority hold that. There are some cases that say if the review is a de novo review, then they uphold them. But in that, I beg to differ with that. The reality is that if a parents are divorcing and they have a newborn, they're settled with this parenting coordinator for the next 18 years. And I submit that it is unrealistic to think that any family can withstand that kind of third-party intervention, emotionally or financially.
Why is this any different than a court appointing a special master in a particular case?
A special master is assigned because of a forensic expertise in terms of accounting engineering or in a complex multi-party construction case, and they have a Floyd Hale, for example, for 2 or 3 years. But this is a non-judicial person that's going right to the heart of the relationship between the parent and the children. And this parenting coordinator has a financial incentive for these conflicts to continue.
I guess what troubles me a bit is this was a stipulated order that was entered. And so I hear your arguments. I understand what you're saying about both the teenage discretion clause and the parenting coordinator clause. But how do we handle legally the basis for unsettling that to which you voluntarily agreed? And you're a lawyer yourself, a very well thought of, well-educated lawyer who had representation, and your opponent, too, had able counsel. So we're left a little with a stipulated situation.
The simple answer is this provision was an agreement to agree.
Okay.
The City of Reno Flying Service and Navy Anderson is outcome determinative. It's black letter law in Nevada. All it said was a parenting coordinator to resolve disputes. I asked my attorney, what's a parenting coordinator? It's a mediator. Great.
Okay. But what about the teenage discretion clause that was agreed to?
It was agreed to, but again, I would urge the court to look at it. And again,
I am looking at it. I'm just saying, legally, how do I deal with the fact that you stipulated to that?
The fact that I'm an attorney... I think
let's leave that you're an attorney out. But it was a stipulated arrangement. There's interpretation issues with it that are fair game. I can see that. But how do you get relief from a stipulation that you entered into?
Because there was no meeting of the minds.
It was drafted
by Mr. Smith. The operative language was drafted by Mr. Smith. It's ambiguous. I mean, you have both of my attorneys submitting affidavits saying it was a request only. You've got Vivian's attorney submitting letters and affidavits after the fact, although the position they took after the fact flies in the face of this letter from Mr. Smith beforehand. I mean, I think I'm entitled to rely upon a statement like that.
You're arguing mistake as a basis for relief from the stipulation.
I'm arguing that it's inherently ambiguous, and that ambiguity is evidenced by the fact that my two attorneys submitted affidavits that was a request, and the other side was submitting affidavits that I should have known that I was going to lose my kids. I would like some time for rebuttal, if possible.
I think you've consumed your time, but I'll extend you 2 minutes, and we'll give the other side 17 minutes to make their argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mm-hmm.
May it please the Court, Record Smith on behalf of Vivian Harrison. The issues before the Court today are issues that were agreed. I think from the tenor of the questions by Justice Douglas, Justice Pickering, that agreement has a substantial place in our society and in the way that we conduct ourselves in regard to children.
Even stipulated agreements are subject to court interpretation. You would agree with that, wouldn't you?
By de novo review, and I understand that, and we'll get into that. But there, the challenge to the agreement is twofold. One is that the agreement is against public policy, and two, that the agreement does not say what it says, that there was an ambiguity, and that ambiguity needs to be read against the drafter. So the public policy issue comes down to the ability of parents to enter into agreements affecting the rights and care of their children. We know from this court's review of that issue in Rivero that we have the right to allow parents to enter those agreements in the absence of violations of public policy, it being unconscionable or illegal. Here the argument is that it is against public policy to ever allow a child to have even limited, very defined discretion to change not custody, but to change only a day or two to see their other parent in certain circumstances. And I want to say that though there wasn't an argument in regard to the merits of the motion itself as to whether or not the child had exercised this provision properly, it had. The court had found that. Because the child had, for example, wanted to go to the mother's home to put on her makeup for prom. She wanted to go with the mother to go buy ballet shoes. She wanted to be with the mother during a time that the other child, for 2 days, was out of the state, and so she would have one-on-one time with the mother. These were the circumstances that the court found where the teenage discretion issue was being used. It was used properly. That was what is intended. You have to look at the context of this case, because this case informs us why we would allow teenage discretion in this circumstance. We had hundreds of thousands of dollars of litigation over two healthy, happy children. Hundreds of thousands of dollars. 1,400 pages of pleadings in regard to these children. So when we entered the agreement, the very same agreement we had proposed before the case was even served on us, when we proposed that agreement, we wanted to ensure that little decisions, like if I want to be with at prom, or I want to have ballet shoe shopping with my daughter, that wasn't the subject of litigation, that the child would have the discretion to enter those decisions. Now, the public policy says that parents have the right, the fundamental right to parent. That's Troxell versus Granville. Those parents can decide, and here expressly decided, that it was in the best interest of the child to have this type of discretion in order to ensure that we didn't have the type of voracious, continued litigation. We set up a process. It's not in a vacuum. The process included a therapist in the other part of this agreement. The therapist would be designed to aid the relationship with Brooke and her father that was strained. We set up a parenting coordinator, a care parenting coordinator that's never been set in place because it's been challenged. We set up a parenting coordinator in order to deal with the therapist so the therapist could keep its hat on of just being a therapist and not address with the problems of the child, and then go to the parenting coordinator. And then we would have a system where the parenting coordinator could mediate the parties as opposed to spending mountains of money on litigation and then ultimately help the court decide. But as Justice Hardesty pointed out, everything in this agreement, both the parenting coordinator agreement and in the teenage discretion provision, all goes back to the court.
Well, that's...
Mike.
I had a question Council indicated earlier that the parenting coordinator had the ability to make these determinations despite any court intervention.
That, of course, is not correct.
Well, my impression, it's just like a special master or a hearing master that makes a recommendation to the court. The court can reject it or accept it. Is it so?
I think Your Honor is absolutely correct, because that's the plain language of the agreement itself. Justice Pickering, the way that this parenting coordinator agreement came about was we had agreed, in essence, to have an agreement, a parenting coordinator agreement. And remember, he was represented not by fine counsel, very fine counsel, who had, at the court's comments in the record, participated in that process to develop the standard order regarding parenting coordinators. So the idea that they didn't understand parenting coordinators, that came in with Tom Standish, unthinkable. They understood what a parenting coordinator did, and they understood the limitations on a parenting coordinator because they had developed a standard language. I used that standard language and submitted it to the court when we couldn't get an answer out of 14 months to appoint a parenting coordinator. So I filed a motion with the court. The court then decided on that motion by first hearing in an opposition in which Mr. Harrison and his attorney set forth their plan, and then the court weighed those plans and came to an agreement as to the order it would enter on its own. That order does not allow any type of teeth whatsoever to this parenting coordinator. I would argue that it should be greater powers, and there should be more discretion to the parenting coordinator, because these parenting coordinators are very common now. They are very common. They form a very important function because there are parents, believe it or not, who can't get along. And so those parents end up spending hundreds of thousands of dollars in litigation so that they can fight over children who are getting destroyed in the process. What we've learned that some of these disputes are so minimal. They're so meaningless. Can we go an extra day on a vacation because we can't find the flight? Can we have the child at the baptism of our other child? These are the kind of things that a parenting coordinator on a day-to-day basis can enter the order. Enter a recommendation. That recommendation is subject to the determination by the court, and solely subject to that determination. The standard under this particular order is satisfaction of the court. So it's just a probable cause standard to say that the issue is decided correctly. It is not the Rule 53 standard, which I think, Justice Peregrine, you mentioned, should be the standard. And I've cited and relied on the Jordan decision because it's the Jordan decision that addresses 53 in a version of 53 that's exactly ours, and addresses the various factors. For example, one of the arguments is that it doesn't provide due process because the parenting coordinator can quickly make decisions on a day-to-day basis. That's not what a master typically does. But the Jordan court likened that to the discretion that the masters have to make day-to-day decisions in terms of the functions of the master and so forth. And these are, again, a vital part of the way that family law is conducted. Let's talk about the I'm going to go back to the teenage discretion provision for a moment.
Can I ask about that, Mr. Smith? That's what I was going to ask about on that. I don't think I've ever seen that being litigated up in the Supreme Court. I don't know how common that is.
Extremely.
Are they? Well,
but they don't get litigated. The reason why they're extremely common is most people recognize at a certain age a child is impossible to actually physically move over to another place. At that point, if you have an established relationship by 16, 17 years old, you're not going to move that child. And that's the location where most of the teenage discretion provisions go.
Let me ask you, I'm just speaking for myself. My concern is this, but on the public policy issue of Rivero, as you discussed, what if you have two parents that are divorced and the kids are at that age are masters of playing one parent against the other? Whoever's more lenient or more rewarding or whatever, they're going to favor that parent at that particular point in time. Doesn't this put the kids just in a position just to aggravate the angst between the two former spouses, like that? Isn't it just a formula for disaster?
Let me suggest that the notion of a new type of manipulation, in other words, saying that I'm going to spend a little bit more time, I think is what you're concerned with, because I think we all know as parents, but children attempt to manipulate their parents by, playing one against the other on a day-to-day basis, even in intact families. But the provision was specifically addressed and agreed to by the parties. This is something different. This is where the parties have made that determination. For example, in your scenario, you said that children were masters at manipulating the parents. Well, these parents know their children. In fact, we like to think they know them better than we do, that we only get a snapshot of their lives, but they know them. So they enter these agreements thinking that these, for example, in this case, straight-A, accomplished, never had a problem in their life children would make responsible choices. And, in fact, she has made responsible choices, and that was the finding of the court. So you're right. It's not a fits-all idea to have this type of provision. But when the parties can weigh it, they can weigh their children, they can weigh the cost of the litigation. And, in fact, I think it's ironic that Mr. Harrison argues that the reason why he did enter the agreement was to avoid litigation.
Let me ask you this. As Justice Pickering hit on earlier, the mistake issue. Was this a mistake?
It was.
The language that was indicated as ambiguous and that he was under a mistaken impression, therefore there was never a meeting of the minds.
There was no mistaken impression because the language that's omitted from the negotiation portion, if we're going to look at what was understood by whom at the time, let me point first out the obvious. The word discretion, under any dictionary meaning whatsoever, means that you have the right to make a choice in a particular circumstance. Every dictionary defines it that way. For him to say, I have a teenage discretion provision, and that the teenager will be granted discretion in this issue, and then to say that against the plain meaning of that word, there's an ambiguity, I think is disingenuous at best, but it becomes more disingenuous when you look at the facts of the case. And if you look at page 7 of my fast-track response, I cite to a letter that was written by Mr. Standish, not by me. Do you remember the letter that we have on the board here was a series of letters, and then Mr. Standish responded. And at the bottom of that letter, it indicates, well, actually, it says, this is what he proposes is the language. It says, thus, while the parents acknowledge the foregoing timeshare arrangement, the parents further acknowledge that agree that absent an objection by the therapist and her parenting coordinator, it is in the best interest of each of their minor children to allow each child the right to exercise such teenage discretion in determining the amount of time the child desires to spend with each parent once the child reaches 16 years of age. So the notion that they didn't know that there was going to be discretion is completely fantabulous. And let me also...
Well, Mr. Smith, if I may interrupt you, please. I'm a little bit confused here on the interpretation of this by the court. In fact, frankly, reading what the court said about this, I can't even figure out what his interpretation was. But in looking at the language, 6.1 says to me, the parties do not intend by this section to give the children the absolute ability to determine their custodial schedule with the other parent.
Correct.
Going further, rather, the parties intend to allow the children to feel comfortable in requesting and or making adjustments to their weekly schedule from time to time. Mr. Harrison's argument is we should strike this provision, but the second part of it, I think, is this is a request. The child can make a request, and the parent who has custody of the child can say no.
Except that would be contrary to the express language of the agreement that says that the child...
Just what I read? You think that's contrary to what I read?
I do. And here's why, Justice Hardesty. The and/or provision, which is something this court has used on several occasions, which I pointed out in my brief, and something that modern scribes have said is perfectly acceptable. The and/or provision has to be read as and or, and it says here that the child has the right to exercise, while the parents acknowledge foregoing arrangement.
Right, but if they wanted to say that it was an absolute right for the child to say, I want to do it this way and make these changes, then why would you have all this additional language? First of all, the first sentence of 6.1, but then the second, where you want the children to feel comfortable in making a request from time to time, it's not a unilateral dictate changes. I mean, I have to say I share Justice Hardesty's reading of this, that certainly the parents wanted the child to be able to say, I request a change, or this week I want to stay at mom's an extra day.
Under your reading of this provision, the child could say, I don't want to be with dad at all. from now until I'm 21.
But if that's what they meant, then why didn't they write it that way?
No, wait. That's not what this provision says. You would have to ignore the remaining parts of the decision. Look, we started with the language that I just read from Mr. Standish's provision. He said that we wanted to have the child to have discretion to determine the amount of time the child spends with each parent. We rejected that notion. That's why we put in all of the various things that Justice Pickering, you pointed out. It's only from time to time. It can't be taken during vacation periods. It cannot erode the visitation. It specifically says it grants the party the right to challenge the provision if there's an erosion of the time, and do so through the parenting coordinator or through the district court. The district court in this provision retains the absolute authority to enter any decision in regard to the use of the discretionary provision. But to read the provision to say that it was only a request, there would be no necessity to have this provision in the agreement at all. A child can always make an request. This old idea that it would create more reasonableness, that you would have to be reasonable in the request, you always have to be reasonable. That's called best interest.
Mr. Smith, since the purpose of all of this was to keep the kids comfortable as between their parents' homes, and to allow them the safety of being able to make these requests, and yet we can't even get to the appointment of a parenting coordinator, is, with all due respect, absurd to me. Because the essence of this agreement says one thing, and the conduct of the parties in this case says something very different. And I know that's not our job, but I would also ask you, since we're talking about public policy and this particular provision, do we need to be concerned as to allowing this type of a provision in here that would feed or serve the ability of one parent to alienate the children?
No, because this provision specifically states, if we'll go down just a few lines, Your Honor, it specifically states that neither party can
6.2 says that.
That's right.
Okay.
So we've included that. We analyzed that. Together, Mr. Standish and I understood. We rejected the notion that they would have absolute determination.
But it's not working too well, is it? I mean,
it works fine. It works. Here's the four instances that were challenged by the motion.
It works fine in the Supreme Court?
It's been challenged. I can't account for it. For example, the person who indicates that they want to limit the litigation has filed five motions since the time of this, two appeals, and has now, nine separate pleadings in regards to the issues. We are subject to answer these things, Your Honor. We wanted the parenting coordinator put in place. We wanted the therapist was put in place, thank goodness.
Let's talk about the parenting coordinator
yes.
a moment.
I have 9 seconds.
One of the challenges that is being made here is that the parenting coordinator abridges one's due process. And you've indicated that the parenting coordinator is there to make decisions maybe that arise on a daily basis.
Could be.
But that they are reviewable by the court. I doubt seriously that the parenting coordinator's decisions on whether the child should be getting dressed at mom's house instead of dad's house for the prom is something that's going to be in front of the district court.
Really? Because it was. That is the nature of the motions on three occasions that was filed by Mr. Harrison and denied by the court, ultimately to the point of sanctioning him. It's a $5,000.
So that raises my point, that underscores my point, that maybe all of this is an utter waste of time and expense, that the judge ultimately has the responsibility to make these decisions. And if that's the frequency of the nature of the disputes, then maybe they ought to be over in the family court daily having the judge sort this out. Because the parenting coordinator isn't contributing to this, or won't.
Well, the parenting coordinator has not yet been appointed, mm-hmm. because as shown in the argument that was made by Mr. Harrison, he relied on the fee agreement that was sentenced by the parenting coordinator, not the order itself. And it's actually the fee agreement that he cites in his brief. That has nothing to do. We rejected that fee agreement. It had nothing to do with the order. In fact, this court specifically ordered, not this court, but the court below, specifically ordered that the parenting coordinator's fee agreement must comply with the terms of the order. So, Your Honor, here's what I would hate to see the court do, because I think this is an opportunity for the court to enter important decisions in regard to both parenting coordination, which is an essential part of the the role of that we have in the court, excuse me, in the custody actions, and then also on the ability of parents to enter agreements that they think are fit for these children. Just because one party challenged the agreement doesn't mean that the agreement isn't sound.
Well, as I said before, even if we agreed with that proposition, I'm concerned about how the district court has interpreted this. I mean, I can't really tell whether the court is enforcing this or not. It's just not clear to me whether the court is saying that the child can make a request to put on their prom dress at mom's house during the time that they are with custody with dad.
No, I believe the order properly read says that the child has the discretion from time to time to choose to modify the normal schedule either way for either parent, provided that schedule, one, isn't prompted by the parents, two, it doesn't erode the time, and three, cannot affect the custodial relationship and only be from time to time. And the reason that language is in there is because we specifically indicated they can't take the schedule. A time-to-time occasional change is not a change in the schedule, and we were very concerned that that would be the...
So the prom dress, how does that come out under this agreement?
It came out that the judge found that was a reasonable use of the teenage discretion provision, as was wanting to go and to the mom's house where she has crafts and so forth to prepare props for the winter dance recital.
So you're reading it's not that it's just an expression of desire, it is an ability to dictate, right?
It's ability to dictate, because again, if it's
as long
only...
As it's infrequent and doesn't disrupt the whole.
As long as it meets the criteria set forth in the plan, and note that if we think that that plan didn't say that, then there was no point in it. There was no point in even including that provision. Children can always make a request to parents, and parents are deemed to have to be reasonable and act in the best interest of the children. Thank
Let
you.
Me ask you one question, just out of curiosity. With your experience in the family court, you've got extensive experience. As
Good years.
Yes, I know. And are these becoming... fairly frequent types of provisions that are putting into they're putting into agreements now?
No, I would say it was a type of provision and really somewhat uniquely rose in the context of this case. I can say that in 30 years of practice, I've never had a case quite like this where we spent hundreds of thousands of dollars litigating the custody of good, healthy, happy, almost straight-A children. So it was a provision that was designed for this particular case, negotiated by very good lawyers, set into the agreement. And it meant what it says, in my view, Justice Hardy. And in regards to
Well, I haven't made up my mind about this, but I do find it interesting that parents who are having trouble making up the decisions for their kids would now empower their kids to decide for them.
I think the leading the factor was the litigation, the fact that was happening to children.
Wait, I'm not finished. I just wanted to make the statement that probably the 67% of the people that do not have attorneys in family court probably never heard of these provisions. Maybe we should suggest that they put this in the self-help center so that we can have more litigation on these issues.
Well, I don't know there would be more litigation. There would be less. When these decisions are made, then you can't decide that, well, our child can't go over to the prom dress. That, to me, is a very bad way to litigate, particularly in the history of this case when every issue is litigated. Even the issues that's decided were litigated.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Smith.
Let me correct something that's really wrong on the record right now. I have no objection to her going to her mother's house for this prom thing. I didn't object on numerous occasions for exceptions that made sense. What is in the record and I objected to is losing and not seeing my daughter for a two-week period of time because of this exercise of discretion. That's what's in the record. This multiple references to this prom thing, I wouldn't let her go to her mother's to do makeup, that's absolutely false.
So none of that was litigated down below?
No.
There was no mention
of
any of this.
There were numerous times I let her go to her mother's house for that.
But there were no motions, no motion practice about that.
No, absolutely no motion practice. But at least three or four times, this the makeup for prom was something I objected to. I never objected to that. Just for the record, my 16-year-old has stopped honoring the joint custody agreement. These provisions in the parental alienation has worked. It is clearly not in the best interest of children for these teenage discretion provisions. There's the only state in this entire 50 states that we have that have addressed these types of provisions is Alabama, and they struck them down each and every time. It is not in the best interest of children to empower a 14, 15, 16, or 17-year-old. this judge's guide that I've got up here, it makes it absolutely clear. It's against public policy, and it's contrary to the best interests of the children to empower them in such a way.
Mr. Harrison, why would you enter into these agreements? You're a skilled attorney. Why would you even consider this?
Well, I had my psychiatrist advising me I had to shut this thing down because there was emotional risk in the litigation. I didn't like this provision, but I'm looking at this thing, and I'm saying I don't like it, but my attorney's giving me assurances. It's just a request. I mean, I don't know why this is not important. That's as unequivocal as you can get. Before I sign this agreement, I get this representation from the guy that wrote the agreement.
But doesn't that also give you the power to say no, 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 no every time there's a request made?
I think the parents ought to have the power to say no, no, no. And they also ought to have the I didn't say no, no, no. Many times I said
it. Mr. Harrison, you have now stressed best interest of the child repeatedly.
Yes.
How can you stand before this court or any other court and argue best interest of the children when this litigation itself clearly is not in the best interest of the children?
Because I believe it's in the best interest of the children not to be exposed and subjected to child abuse or parental alienation. I believe strongly that parents in this state are being taken advantage of with these teenage discretion provisions. I think it's appalling that we have the record that took place before the May 21st hearing where the judge said they're normally just a one-line teenage discretion. The child shall have teenage discretion. I think that ought to concern every member of this court.
But that's not the case here. And the other chief, if I may, very briefly. The family court judges certainly have discretion to listen to the child's preference in making a custody decision.
Absolutely.
And a child at the age of 14, they presume, is able to provide input as to where that child wants to live.
Absolutely.
Okay, and so why is this so terribly different? If they have the ability to provide meaningful input at that level, why don't they...
Here's the absolute huge difference. In that setting, the child is still only making a request. They're not empowered to determine anything. The judge is making the determination of custody. They entertain the request of the child, just as under the judge's guide, they entertain the view of the child. But they stress the importance of advising the child. It's not your responsibility to determine what's in your best interest. This is upside down in a big way in this state. And again, the fact that there's not a case anywhere else in the country except Alabama, and every one of those cases without exception strikes these types of provisions. It's not in the best interest of a child. This child's
Can you give us some examples and sites and perhaps some supplemental authority on states that have stricken this type of a provision that's fairly similar?
I have researched. The only reported decisions are out of Alabama, and they're struck every time. And just so you know, this judge's guide is based upon treatises. There was a 34-year study sponsored by the American Bar Association, the Family Law Section of the American Bar Association. Parental alienation involving 1,000 cases. This treatise, the findings and conclusion are binding the treatise, Children Held Hostage by Stanley S. Clower. This judge's guide is based upon that. You are absolutely inviting parental alienation with these provisions, and it is the worst, one of the worst forms of child abuse.
Okay, Mr. Harrison, I believe we understand your argument. We understand that of Mr. Smith's and his clients. We'll conclude this at this point. And thank you for your arguments, and the case will stand.